Programming supported by Great River Energy, providing reliable electric service to 28 Minnesota member co-ops with a diverse mix of power generation, including power plants and renewable energy. Great River Energy, the power behind your electric cooperative.
I'm Carrie Miller, and this is NPR News. Now in depth on the fact and fiction of a shootout in a frontier town. I asked for recognizable Western music, and that's what I got. Walk among the graves of Boot Hill in Tombstone, Arizona, and you'll find the names of the McLaurys and Billy Clanton. They died in a gunfight that has been memorialized in music and movies and myth. Indeed, novelist Mary Doria Russell writes, "Year after year, everything that did and did not happen during those 30 seconds of confusion and noise, smoke and pain, will be analyzed and described, distorted and disputed," and it has. Her new novel is called Epitaph, a novel of the OK Corral, and she joins us today from Cleveland, Ohio. Mary, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
Do you think those nine men, it is nine men, isn't it? The Earps, Clanton, McLaurys themselves, ever?
Yes, and two of them ran away. Billy Claiborne. Okay. Was also involved in it.
You think they ever fully understood what happened?
I'm not sure that anyone fully understands what happened, because you had over 100 people witness the gunfight. And in the inquest that took place starting that night, there were already so many disputes, and nobody saw everything. Nobody saw it all. Everybody had a little piece of it. And so it was almost impossible to put together a really accurate notion of what happened.
It's interesting, isn't it, with all those eyewitnesses and what we now know about the flaws in eyewitness testimony.
Right? That's right.
This
yes.
is part of the reason we understand why what really happened is so confusing and so difficult to try to piece out.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, even today when we have people with cell phones taking videos of incidents like this, there is still argument about why and what and exactly what the motives were and who did what when and who felt threatened. All of that stuff still happens. Very little has changed.
That's true. So for the OK Corral, is it right for me to say that I sense that you are more interested in what happened before and is interested in what happened after as you are in the 30 seconds of the actual shooting?
Yeah, the 30 seconds itself. I tried to see it as accurately as somebody would have in the middle of it. I saw it through Tom McLaurie's eyes. Poor Tommy. He's one of my favorite people involved with this. He was, I think, a real innocent. And he and his brother were on their way to their sister's wedding when this gunfight took place. I don't think that they meant to come to Tombstone and start a fight. So it was understanding all of the pressures, large and small, individual and international, that led to those 30 seconds that I spent the bulk of the book on. And then seeing the aftermath, you know, in the movies, you shoot people and it's just over. Well, we know even today, and in 1881, the same thing was true. There was a month-long hearing to determine whether or not the officers involved were justified in shooting. There was a lot of law involved with this and a lot of psychological and emotional after effects that I thought were important to portray.
You know, I noted what you said about Tom McLaurie. He was a real innocent. Is he the only real innocent in all of the people that were involved in it?
Possibly. I'm not sure. I have a tendency to want to defend Doc Holliday in this as well, in the effort to make Wyatt Earp the hero of the story, which took place many, many years after the gunfight itself. There was a tendency to offload any responsibility that Wyatt might have had for the events that led to the gunfight. And Doc had been dead for a long time, and he had no family that cared to defend him. he was unable to sue for slander or libel. And so he got blamed for things that I don't think were really his fault in any way.
But he wasn't a true innocent. I mean,
he was trying to leave Tombstone as well. I mean, he was in Tucson on his way out of town.
But he had,
and was drawn back by the ERPs.
Is it fair to say that he had, well, his reputation had preceded him, whether that's totally fair or not.
That's right.
That's the, and he was somewhat instrumental in the events that led to the rising tensions that ultimately perhaps led to the OK Corral?
Well, to the extent that each one of these individuals was at some level involved. I mean, the, other than Tom, who really didn't have anything to do with this and was there with his brother, Frank,
Tom
who was
McLaurie.
A handful and did tend to take offense very easily and did draw his gun. Not all the way, but partially. He was one of the ones who showed the pistol, and that led to the opening of fire. They're all grown-ups. They all had complicated lives. They were all enmeshed with one another at one level or another. And you also had the mayor of the town who insisted that Virgil Earp enforce the quite draconian gun laws in Tombstone.
Right.
You didn't just check your gun. You had to check any lethal weapon, including knives. And all of this was taking place just a few weeks after President Garfield had died because of an assassin's bullet. And so there was this nationwide revulsion against gun violence that took place after Garfield was killed. So all of that was going on.
Your context is so important here, and I don't want to lose it. Tombstone, what you just said about Garfield is important. Tombstone
yes.
itself is this place where there's a lot of money to be made quickly by men who have flooded in, gone out to the silver mines and come back, and they're feeling flush, and they want a way to spend it. I mean, there's an atmosphere in this town of what? Volatility and unpredictability. And that contributes to the reasons they passed the laws that they did, right? And the tension that the townspeople can feel. Is that fair to say?
You really have a very clear political split that mirrors the kind of political split that we have today. In Tombstone, you had industrialists and business people and lawyers and engineers, and they wanted drunks and guns off the city streets. They were Yankees for the most part. They were Lincoln men, Republicans, and they had very little interest in the kind of ranching and cattle operations that were going on in outside of the city in Cochise County. In the county, the ranchers are nearly all ex-Confederates. These are Southern Democrats, and they really resented the way that Yankees had flooded into this silver camp, and it turned into quite a large city within months. And suddenly they were the minority political party in their own homes, and they felt that they were under siege. And in Tombstone, you had basically MSNBC versus Fox News. You had two newspapers that were very happy to spin whatever happened in the direction of their the people who read their newspapers. So there's a great deal of quite contemporary political tension.
You write of this atmosphere in Tombstone. Nearly 2,000 men were working in a dozen silver mines, but competition was fierce among those who wished to feast on their wages. You know what it reminded me of, Mary? The boom towns in North Dakota. I don't know how
yes.
much you've read about that.
Yeah,
but
yeah, very similar.
We're kind of getting a glimpse of that today, aren't we?
Yeah, exactly. This was in the middle of a very long-lasting depression, too. That's the other thing. In 1873, there was an economic crash, and it's centered on a railroad bubble that had burst after the Civil War. And the same kind of thing is with our housing bubble in 2008, where the the economic outcome of that lingers for years and years. And some people are doing very, very well, and other people are still feeling left behind and in really desperate economic conditions. And so when you have a natural resource that suddenly gets exploited, like this enormous silver strike in Tombstone, or the oil fields in the Dakotas today, guys just rush in, and often they leave any family that they have behind. The housing is very difficult to find in these boom towns. There's volatility when you get a lot of Y chromosomes bunched up in one place.
I was going to say, you know, and I think we've also seen this in North Dakota. You see men, mostly men, mm-hmm. untethered from a lot of the lot of their family, the social restrictions, I guess, that would bind them in some ways in their real lives. They're in some ways they're not living their real life, I guess, when they're sure. out. You know, when a boom town springs up like this, I'm going to get calls saying that's
not
true.
Watched, but... They're not being watched by their parents. They right. don't have a wife or a sweetheart. The minister they might have paid attention to when they were back home is far away. All restraints have lost.
Mary Doria Russell is with us. If you've just tuned in, we're talking about her new novel. It's called Epitaph, a novel of the OK Corral. And when I've been talking to friends about this and talking about this on the air, I have to say, I am not a fan of Westerns, but Mary made me a believer. This is such a good novel. So much great characterization. And we're having a conversation today about how she investigated what happened before and after and during, of course, the shootout at the OK Corral. If you have some questions about that, if you're curious about the way you've seen it represented in movies or in books, I think that'd be fun to talk about. 651. Good. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. You can tweet me your question. It's at Carrie, KerriMPR. Mary, you were going to say about when I mentioned the movies.
There have been over 40 feature films those 30 seconds. Literally 1,000 books, I think, and my own included. But from the very beginning, because of the fact that it almost immediately became an iconic moment. Those 30 seconds, even in 1881, were the focus of international news. It has had to be simplified and scrubbed up and changed. And ultimately, you have fiction based on fiction based on fiction. And what I was trying to do was get back to the real people, peel away the mythology, find the core of historical truth, and work with that instead of just accepting the way it had been portrayed in movies for so many years.
I guess your training as an anthropologist helped you do that, didn't it?
Yes. Yeah. I'm used to having giant projects that I chew on for 3 years at a time.
Yeah, but you also bring a scientist's power of observation to this, right? You don't say the story says this and the witnesses said this and that's the account I will take. I mean, you're digging into the culture that would have influenced the way people thought about what happened.
Yeah, absolutely. I often have to tell people, remember that the past is not just now, but with horses.
What does that mean?
Well, for example, both Ike Clanton and Wyatt Earp were raised by men who routinely beat their children. But the past is not just now, but with horses. You have to put that in context. In the past, it was considered good parenting to beat the devil out of small children. What's important to understand about the context, though, is that both Nicholas Earp and Newton Clanton were considered unusually brutal, even for their own time. So finding that out, understanding the childhood of men like Ike Clanton and Wyatt Earp, that kind of deep research and contextual research allowed me to see how much those two men had in common and why. We know that Wyatt and Ike Clanton made a deal that went sour. The idea was to have Ike rat out three people who were thought to be guilty of a stagecoach robbery. And Ike would get the reward and Wyatt would get the arrest, and that would make him look good politically. This was the deal. Mm-hmm. It fell apart because those three guys were killed before Ike had a chance to rat them out. And he became so frightened that the deal was going to be discovered and that he would be killed for being a rat, that was the real trigger moment for the gunfight. So if you don't understand how much they had in common, you have to ask yourself, why are Wyatt and Ike Clanton making this deal?
Exactly.
We know they did that. What was the basis of their trust? And I think it's because they understood one another.
To the phones to Carrie in Rothsay. Hi, Carrie. Your question for Mary Doria Russell.
Hi. I just had it's kind of a thought, or you had mentioned earlier about places where men work, like in Williston or comparing to Tombstone.
Yeah.
And the culture, and I just thought it would be an interesting conversation. Has there been, and what would it be like, if there were communities where it was primarily women working, and what the culture of society would be like, or
good
what
question.
Has it been like if that has occurred?
Mary?
The Triangle Shirtwaist Factory comes to mind. Where there are workforces that are almost exclusively women, but they are being managed by men, that's a possibility that could yield some insight into that idea.
You know, Mary, I think Carrie asks just the right question, too, because one of the things that I take away from the novel, and one of the things that I guess I find boring about Westerns, is the women seem so one-dimensional. But you've told us so much about the backstory of the women who were with Doc Holliday and with Wyatt Earp and how influential they were on how those
really
men behaved. Yeah.
They're at the heart of this story. They're the real backbone. And the fact that Josie Marcus, we have to call her Wyatt's wife. They were never legally married, but, you know, 49 years together counts. And if it were not for Josie's increasing obsession with making sure that Wyatt's name was clear and that he was remembered the way she thought he deserved to be, we would not know his name at all. This would have been something that was just in the dustbin of history. She became increasingly frantic to make sure that she could give her husband the epitaph that she believed he deserved. So, I mean, that's one of the reasons I named this book Epitaph, because Josie and I are to some extent rivals in that project.
But also the name of the newspaper.
The name of the newspaper was the Tombstone Epitaph. Every tombstone needs an epitaph. That was the motto, yeah.
Just to leave Josie Marcus here, we could do a whole show just on Josie Marcus. How much of that backstory is historical fact, and how much of it is you saying, this is what I know about her and this is what I think could have happened?
There is a very good biography called Lady at the OK Corral that gives a lot of the factual information. She was from Brooklyn. The father is often said to be a banker, but I actually saw the census report that from Brooklyn, and I think that people are misinterpreting the handwriting. I think it said Baker.
Wow, you saw the census report?
Yeah, well, yeah, that's easy. I mean, you just look up census reports. Anybody with Ancestry.com can rummage through that kind of thing.
So you think there was no N in that description of what he did?
I think there was no N in that. Yes,
because that is an important part of she learns how to be an excellent baker, and she takes that skill to Tombstone. And Wyatt Earp has a sweet tooth, so that's important.
We do know that Wyatt Earp had a tremendous sweet tooth, and that man would add sugar to anything that would sit still. He had terrible teeth, and we know that he had two rounds of quite extensive dental work, the first of which was carried out by John Henry Holliday, DDS, in Dodge City.
Oh.
That was how they met.
Oh, my gosh. Mary, those descriptions of the dentistry that must have taken place back then. Oh, God. Did they most often just pull your teeth if you were in a lot of pain?
Yeah, a quick yank was usually the best way to handle it. But it's important to know, too, that dentistry was at least 50 years ahead of medical care in the 1800s. And Doc Holliday got his he was a doctor of dental surgery. He got his degree from the finest dental school in the country. He was quite beautifully educated and well-trained, and his uncle was also a surgeon. They used ether. They understood the importance of sterilizing their instruments. They rinsed everything in carbolic. They used antiseptic procedures. So you were much better off in the hands of a dentist than you were in a with a medical doctor or a surgeon.
Mary Doria Russell is with us. She's a writer. Her new novel is called Epitaph, a novel of the OK Corral. We haven't talked much about Doc Holliday. We will. We'll get a look at the latest news. And when we come back, we'll talk about her representation of Doc Holliday and what an interesting person and character, and where history, I guess, gets that right and wrong. And then I have a question here about what actually happened at the OK Corral from a listener. We'll get to that as well. So stay with us. But to John Wanamaker now. And John, what's your top story?
Kerry, Russia's foreign minister, has arrived in Lausanne, Switzerland, where Iran and six world powers, including Russia, have been trying to reach an agreement limiting Iran's nuclear program. His arrival is a sign that the talks are wrapping up as a deadline for the framework understanding arrives. Officials say there will be a general statement agreeing only to continue the talks in a new phase. Iraq's prime minister says Iraqi forces have reached the center of Tikrit in their push to retake the city from Islamic State Group. He says security forces already have retaken neighborhoods on the southern and western edges of the city and are moving to control the entire city. The large-scale operation to recapture Saddam Hussein's hometown began on March 2nd. However, it stalled until U.S. forces joined the offensive, launching airstrikes last week. Some bad news for low-income and first-time homebuyers. More homes financially out of reach for the would-be buyers. A closely watched index of home prices finds that they rose by 4.6% in January from 12 months earlier. Prices are rising at a faster pace than earnings, making it harder for buyers to save for a down payment and afford a monthly mortgage. Fewer Americans are listing their homes for sale, and the tight supply has kept prices higher. This is Minnesota Public Radio News.
Wednesday on Morning Edition, fears of exploding oil trains are driving new efforts to train first responders, and the training goes far beyond firefighting. I'm Phil Picardi. Listen for that story and all the news on tomorrow's Morning Edition.
Support for this program comes from Bremer Bank, offering money management tools and services designed to help companies save time and do more with their money. More about Bremer Business Banking at bremer.com. Bremer Bank. Work hard, bank easy.
Programming is supported by Summit Orthopedics, offering arthritis care for healthy, active lifestyles. For joint replacement, Summit performs surgeries on-site with an overnight care suite stay and SecureTrax therapy. Arthritis specialists and risk assessments at summitortho.com. Programming is supported by Great River Energy, providing reliable electric service to 28 Minnesota member co-ops with a diverse mix of power generation, including power plants and renewable energy. Great River Energy, the power behind your electric cooperative.
Hey, coming up later in the hour, Tracy Mumford joins us for our Thread Book Question of the Week. And I want to let you know that Mary Doria Russell is going to stick around for a few questions for our podcast. So you can find that when we post it, and that'll be sometime later in the day. She's with us today. We're talking about her newest novel, Epitaph, a novel of the OK Corral. And Mary, a question for you here from Bob in St. Paul. Hey, Bob, thanks for waiting.
Yeah, quick comment and then the question. Sure. I was on a cycle tour earlier this winter. I went through Tombstone, and of course, it's become a typical tourist trap of a thing. Yep. The guns sound like cap guns rather than large caliber handguns. My question is this. My understanding is that the gunfight actually took place in an alley next to a photographic shop and not actually in the corral. What I'm wondering is kind of the lore idea of the corral, is that kind of why they use that for the mythology rather than like an alley, which seems kind of like more like a modern, kind of more urban?
Yeah, it's interesting that an alley does sound sort of more like Chicago than a frontier town. Although you have to remember the Tombstone was 23,000 people and quite built up. It very early on became known as the gunfight at the OK Corral because it took way too long to say the officer involved shooting in the alley behind Fly's photography studio near the corner of First and Fremont, a little north of the OK Corral. So that was just the first of many simplifications that were necessary to sum this conflict up.
Be honest, I'm sure you've seen the recreation of the shootout, right? How good is it?
I actually know the guys who do the reenactment of the shootout. There's a half hour play written by Stephen Keith, and he inhabits Doc Holliday 360 days out of the year, three times a day. I find it a little eerie to be sitting in the the gift shop at the OK Corral, listening to friends of mine saying tickets for the gunfight, tickets for the gunfight, over and over again. It's bizarre, and that was one of the things that I really wanted to address with this novel: the very fact that the most awful 30 seconds of these people's lives has become entertainment for hundreds of millions of people around the world. And you have all of these movies that have been made. And I don't think that to me, this was a tragedy on the level of the Iliad of Homer. Instead, it has become this, little kid shoot 'em up thing. The reenactment in Tombstone, I think, is not bad. It's a good place to start. But the story itself, I think, needs more than half hour to tell.
You know, to what you were just saying about the entertainment versus the most consequential 30 seconds of these people's lives. I mean, this seared individuals and families' lives
for life.
Yeah.
Generations level later. I mean, the McLowry family, they are still bitter about what they feel. These are people's history. It's not just Wyatt and Doc's story. This is the story of the McLowrys. This is the story of the Clantons. There are Clantons who still live in the Tombstone area. In order to understand how this hit people, try to imagine. Think about Trayvon Martin's and George Zimmerman's. Mm-hmm. Conflict. Okay, Trayvon Martin ends up dead. George Zimmerman is exonerated in a court of law. Now, it's hard for Trayvon Martin's family not to feel pretty bitter about the outcome of that. But try to imagine how they would feel if there were 40 feature films showing George Zimmerman as a handsome hero and Trayvon Martin as a violent gangbanger who deserved to die. And then you'll get a sense of how truly unfair the portrayals of all of these people feel. Wyatt himself, nobody thinks of Ike Clanton as a hero, but Wyatt himself wasn't considered a hero until after World War I. And I believe that what happened then was that we had the loss of so many millions of men for wholesale lots. And the public became hungry for human-sized stories of conflict with real heroes. And it was in the aftermath of World War I that the conflict in Tombstone was resurrected as a simple story of lawmen versus cattle thieves and good guys versus bad guys. And Wyatt became a sort of I'm blanking on the guy's name, but the one who put Al Capone in jail.
Oh, Elliot Ness.
Elliot Ness versus the Capone gang. Uh-huh. Because that was the context of the 1920s and 30s. But at the time, one of the big surprises to me when I was doing the research was that, because I thought this is cattle rustlers versus lawmen. No, cattle had nothing to do with this. Yeah. There were no cows involved in any way with the gunfight at the OK Corral.
You know, Mary, then I wonder how Doc Holliday fits into what you've just said, into that equation, because he seems like a man so out of place in Tombstone and 1880, but he's become this iconic figure of the West. And I mean, he's a Latin-speaking trained dentist, as you noted, in circumstances that, if this is true, turned him into a gunslinger.
No, he was never a gunslinger.
Well,
I don't even know what a gunslinger is. he was diagnosed with advanced tuberculosis when he was 22 years old. This is a beautifully educated Southern gentleman who spoke Latin and Greek and read Flaubert in the original French and was educated for a life in the East. He would have practiced with his cousin Robert in Atlanta, and you never would have heard of him if it hadn't been for the fact that he was diagnosed with tuberculosis. Like so many other Easterners, he went west because there was a theory that the sunshine and the dry air of the American desert would be good for his lungs. And he did live for an additional 15 years. He was given 12 to 18 months to live if he stayed in Atlanta. So in some sense, it was good for him. He couldn't make a living doing dentistry. And everything else on the frontier demanded either stamina or strength. He had neither. This was a very sick man his entire adult life. He played cards because that took nerve, not strength. He was deeply, profoundly ashamed of being a professional gambler. It was the male equivalent of being a prostitute in the 1800s. Hmm. It was doing something for money that respectable people did for pleasure. And he never told his family that he was a gambler. They found out when the gunfight hit the newspapers. The tombstone epitaph was on the AP Wire. So it was known back in Atlanta. And he was right to have been worried. His father never spoke his name again. It was a terrible disgrace.
Let me ask you this. I mean, it seems like then that outsidership, you know, that outsider's perspective that he brought to Tombstone meant that, I mean, I tended, I guess, to rely on him in your novel as the truest perspective. He was my reliable narrator. Should he have been?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Hmm. I think that he tried to be fair. I think that he was he had that kind of distanced and sophisticated eye with which to look at what was going on around him. It's really, you know, this is a man who reads Anthony Trollope, you know. he has insight into human nature that comes from being a reader. The real friendship was not with Wyatt Earp, who was barely literate, but with Wyatt's brother Morgan, who was a reader. That was the close relationship. And, you know, one of the things that I tried to point out at the end of the book was that most portrayals in the movies make Morgan Earp into sort of a cardboard character who has to get killed so that Wyatt and Doc can ride on the Vendetta ride and avenge his death.
Right.
Well, you know, I don't think Wyatt wanted Doc with him. I mean, who's
and
the last person?
And you make that kind of clear in the novel.
Yeah, it's like, okay, we're going to be riding hard over bad terrain, looking for very dangerous men.
Stay
who
behind.
Do we want on our posse? Let's get a guy who might collapse or cough at the wrong time. It's like, no, no.
I have to say, I think that's a really poignant representation that you've done on that ride that they're taking together. It's so obvious that Doc Holliday knows that Wyatt doesn't want him with him, and yet he feels kind of honor-bound to be there.
He has to bear witness. Yeah, he has to bear witness. And, you know, there's a wonderful line in the movie Tombstone, and I like Tombstone. I like that movie.
Yeah.
Where Doc Holliday says, you know, Wyatt Earp is my friend, and one of the other characters says, well, I got a lot of friends, and Doc says, I don't. I think that that might have been accurate, but he would have been talking about Morgan was my friend. And he didn't have a lot of other friends. So I just think that there has been this need to simplify the story. And I think that it makes much more sense psychologically and historically to portray it the way that I have, where it's almost an accident that Doc Holliday is involved with the Vendetta.
So I have a theory about you based on no fact at all. But Just because pianos turn up so frequently in this novel,
yes.
I think you're a late in life piano student.
I am.
You
yes.
are.
Yes.
I knew it.
Yes,
knew
and
it.
And late in life, my teacher, Marjorie Gilbert, is 93 years old.
Oh, my gosh. When did you take it up, and why did you start playing?
Okay, well, having written Doc, which came out about 4 years ago, Doc is sort of a fictional biography of Doc Holliday, and it was because his mother was a piano teacher who started his lessons when he could reach the keyboard. He was immersed in the 19th century piano repertoire. And to write for him, I needed to know about that. So I started, you know, just listening and fell in love with Chopin. I mean, this is somebody who, ahead of this, before I wrote Doc, I was like, it was more like 1980s heavy metal hair bands, you know, Def Leppard, Van Halen.
That's the kind of music that you liked?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah, that was going in.
I can't imagine it.
As soon as I finished the last revision of Doc and sent it into the publisher for publication, the first thing I did was to go out and buy a piano. And I started lessons when I was 59 years old because it was already 55 years too late to start when I was four. So there was like no time to waste.
And are you keeping up with the lessons?
I took about 18 months off during the effort to finish Epitaph, but I started lessons again in December and with a new teacher, with Marguerite Gilbert, and she is just wonderful. She has a lot of students who are in their 60s now, who maybe took lessons when they were kids and kept it up until high school or college and then lost it. And now they're retired and they want to go back and play the instrument again. I'm the only one I know of that she has taken on who was like dead ignorant walking in.
She's 90. Did you say 90?
93. Yeah.
I can't
She's
even
extraordinary
imagine.
Woman.
Oh, my gosh. There's a story in a novel waiting about her, it sounds like. Hey, Mary, quick question here off Twitter. And a listener says, not related to the book, but any news on the TV adaptation of your science fiction novel, The Sparrow? Anything
yes.
happening with that?
Yeah, that once again has fallen through. And I want to tell everybody who wants there to be a film or TV adaptation, you are glad that I said no. You know, it's like if somebody came to Harper Lee and said, you know, we just love To Kill a Mockingbird, but does the father have to be a lawyer? What if he were the sheriff? And
oh,
then
no.
when the lynch mob comes for Jim at the end, then he could fight him off and there'd be like third act would be real full of action. And does Boo Radley really have to be an adult male autistic? What if it was a really hot chick? You know, it's like they change everything that readers love about the book.
Oh, my gosh. Mary, thank you. So this has just been delightful. And I am thrilled you're going to stay around for the podcast. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mary Doria Russell's newest novel is called Epitaph, A Novel of the OK Corral.